Forecast for Washington this week, cloudy with rising tempers.
Well, Senator McCarthy, so far as I'm concerned, this committee, you're going to get one of the most complete investigations ever given in the history of this republic.
The National Broadcasting Company's News and Special Events Department brings you Voices and Events, the living record of history this week. You'll hear Senators Joseph McCarthy and Brian McMahon, election news from Radio Moscow, General Omar Bradley, Fred Allen, these and many others. The actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, here's your Voices and Events editor, James Fleming.
This was the week that a girl from Brooklyn and a man from Russia were convicted of spying against the government of the United States.
Any credit for this victory must go principally to the FBI, for without the vigilance and the perseverance of its agents, Ms. Copeland and the Russian Gubachev would never have been apprehended, let alone convicted.
That was the government prosecutor, John Kelly. Attorneys for the defense thought differently. Counsel for the Russian was Abraham Pomerantz.
The jury found that Ms. Copeland did not attempt to pass any papers to Gubachev, but in the next breath it found that Gubachev did attempt to receive papers from Copeland. Now, if you can figure out how Gubachev could attempt to receive documents from Ms. Copeland without Ms. Copeland attempting to pass them to him, well, you're just a better lawyer than I am.
But this was a trial much larger than the story of Judith Copeland and Valentine Gubachev. It had its roots in the Cold War, its ramifications all along the diplomatic front. That was clearly apparent in the order to Gubachev to leave the country with his sentence suspended, an extraordinary procedure before American law. The day of the sentencing, in a restaurant across from the federal courthouse, the noontime conversation was concerned with nothing else.
The phase of it that intrigues me the most, and it seems to me provokes the most thought, has been the request, apparently on behalf of the State Department, as well as on behalf of the Justice Department, to permit Gubachev to return to his native land. And that provokes the thought, or the possible implication of some idea of reciprocity.
Indeed, the Department of State was quick to confirm that its treatment of Gubachev was based on the hope that there would be no Russian reprisals against American citizens, that perhaps some Americans already in communist hands would receive the same lenient treatment. This was the administration attitude. It didn't sit well with the opposition. For example, Republican Senate leader Kenneth Wherry, well, he was indignant.
If there was any merit to Russia's claim that Gubachev was immune from prosecution, Mr. Etchison should have recognized it before the Russian spy was put to trial. But having asserted Gubachev was subject to prosecution, Mr. Etchison should have let the law take its course and not meddle with the processes of justice. A jury of American citizens found Gubachev guilty. By what authority does Mr. Etchison say? Who shall go to jail and who shall go free after conviction? Sentencing one person to 15 years in prison and freeing another after the same offense makes a travesty of justice. The apology of the State Department that freeing Gubachev will spare hardship for Americans behind the Iron Curtain is indeed risky business. Trading Gubachev for an American prisoner behind the Iron Curtain does not conform to the judicial processes of the United States. It is certainly not sound public policy. Russia's friendship cannot be won by bribery, as freeing her spies who plot the destruction of America. Mr. Etchison's bungling of the Gubachev case is further evidence of why he is unfit to be Secretary of State.
Nowhere were politics and diplomacy more thoroughly entangled than before the Congress of the United States this week. The scene was again the ornate caucus room of the Senate. High ceiling, marble walls, glittering chandeliers. Here the midget sat on J.P. Morgan's knee. Here General Bennett Myers and Howard Hughes faced their accusers. This week, it was a hunt for subversives. In the witness chair, the star player, the Republican senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy. Presiding over the investigating committee, the Democratic senator from Maryland, Millard Tydings.
Senator McCarthy, if you'll listen to me a moment, I think you and I probably can arrive at an understanding.
I'm sure we can.
We're conducting a hearing, and you're in the position of being the man who occasioned this hearing, and so far as I'm concerned, this committee, you're going to get one of the most complete investigations ever given in the history of this republic, so far as my abilities will permit.
From the outset, tempers were very high. The Wisconsin lawmaker charged the State Department with harboring several score bad security risks. This was his moment.
Let us take the case of Dorothy Kenyon. This lady, according to the
Senator
latest
McCarthy,
issue...
Senator McCarthy, is that one of the cases you brought up on the Senate floor?
This is not.
Oh, I see. Go ahead.
This lady has been affiliated with at least 28 Communist Front organizations, all of which have been declared subversive by an official government agency. For the guidance of the committee, I hand you herewith Exhibit B, which fully documents Miss Kenyon's affiliation with the National Council of American-Soviet Friendship.
Senator, that National Council of American-Soviet Friendship, that had quite a vogue when we were co-belligerents back during the war days. I may be in error, but I think that there were a couple of senators of the United States who are still members of this body, who were members of that organization at the time. Are you aware of that?
The senator is talking about war days. This document is dated late 1948, November 1648. And Senator, I may say this, that I have not declared these organizations subversive. I tell you in each instance which official bodies have. In this case, it is declared subversive, just a second, by the House Un-American Activities Committee, the California Un-American Activities Committee, and the Attorney General. I assume when they declared this organization subversive, they did it upon very confident proof.
The hearing, with a continued show of petulance all around, progressed to some angrier moments. Case 14 set off the hottest exchange. It concerned the State Department. Committee Democrat McMahon took over questioning in this round two, and the battle was on. It was McCarthy versus McMahon.
Chairman, as I understand it, yesterday you notified Senator McCarthy that this case was to be subject of discussion today.
That's right.
I take it, Senator, that you have prepared yourself and brought with you everything that you have on case 14.
Everything of any moment that I have on case 14 has been read into the congressional record.
Will you show me what you have on case 14?
Just read the congressional records before you. That's what
will
I have in
produce,
case 14.
Will you produce, Senator, for my inspection, what you have on case 14?
I am telling you what I have on case 14 is in the congressional record.
Will you produce what you have on case 14 for
sure,
my inspection
if somebody
at this
will,
time?
If you'll hand me the
or
congressional...
Or do I have to get a subpoena for it, Senator?
Senator, I have gotten through telling you that what I have on case 14 is in the congressional records. Now, just be quiet.
Now, just a minute, Senator.
No.
Just a minute. If you
let
please.
Me finish this question,
please.
Quiet first. Quiet first.
Chairman,
may I finish?
Quiet first. Quiet first.
May I finish the answer, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, now, I have a question pending,
right.
And I insist on an answer to it.
Just a moment. I'll ask the stenographer to turn back to the question of the senator from Connecticut.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I want a responsive answer.
Will you produce for my inspection
I can't help
everything
it.
You have on case 14?
If somebody will hand me the congressional record, I will produce for you all I have on case 14. It's a very complete case in the congressional record. That is what I have on case 14.
Next question. Senator, you have brought with you your file on case 14 and all related papers, according to your own statement, of any consequence. Will you or will you not produce them for my inspection right now?
I will produce for your inspection everything I've got in case 14. It is all in the congressional record.
I'm not interested in looking at the congressional record. I'm interested in what information the senator has in his possession. I'd like to see it. I'd like to see it now. If he won't give it to me, that's his privilege.
I'm glad to give it to you, Senator. I'm telling you again that
let me
all...
have it, Senator.
Let me finish, please.
Let the witness answer.
I'd be glad to give it to you. I gave the Senate all of the information I had in case number 14. That is the extent of the file. It's all in the congressional record. Now, if the senator questions the truthfulness of that, the only way he can determine, as far as I know, is by subpoenaing the files.
I'm left with the unfortunate opinion that the senator has material in his possession on this case, which he refuses to turn over to the committee. He again and again has stated that we can go to other places to get it. And he again says that everything he has, he's put in the record. But I think if I was in the senator's place, what I would do is say, yes, here's what I have on case 14. And turn it over to us. I'm very much disappointed, Mr. Chairman, that the senator takes the attitude that he does. I won't give the committee the matters that are in his possession, which bear upon this very serious case. I regret very much that the senator takes that attitude.
May I answer that, Mr. Chairman? And I regret very much, Senator, that this committee seems so vitally interested in finding out whether they can get the names of anyone in the State Department who, good, loyal Americans who may have given me information. You're not fooling me, Senator. I know what you want. I know what the State Department wants. They want to find out who is giving out the information on these disloyal people so their heads will fall. And as far as I'm concerned, gentlemen, no heads will fall, no heads of any loyal people in the State Department. None of those heads will fall because of their having possibly imparted information to me. So you're not fooling me, Senator. You know the information. Now, let me finish. You know the information is in the file. You know you can get it. You know that if you want any of those names, you can get them. I knew, I've been informed, I'm sure of it, that the State Department is very curious to know whether or not someone in that department is telling me who has communistic activities, who belong to these commie front organizations. I know they want those names. I'm very surprised and disappointed, Senator, that this committee would become the tool of the State Department, not Senator, not to get at the names, the information of those who are bad security risks, but to find out for the department who may have given me information so that those people can be kicked out of a job tomorrow.
I am profoundly shocked.
Quiet.
I am profoundly shocked by the irresponsible speech that has just been made by the senator from Wisconsin. His imputation to me, the members of this committee, of any such motive in asking that question is something that I repudiate and denounce. It's unworthy of any senator of the United States. We're engaged in responsible business. If there is to be this kind of irresponsible talk, it won't be in the best interests of the United States. And I say to you, Senator, when you start making charges of that kind against me, you better reflect on it more than once.
Senator, you can be sure that everything I say has been very carefully reflected upon.
I doubt it.
And I think that this attempt, let me say this. I know this is going to continue during this hearing. The very clear-cut, obvious attempt not to get at the facts, not to find out what is in the files. You know you can find it out. But this obvious attempt to try and find the name of some State Department official, some loyal person, who has come down to a senator and said, now, here are facts. Here are things that should be brought to the attention of the Senate. Try to get their names so their heads will fall. I think, Senator, that's shameful. And I think it's obvious to everyone here what's going on.
The questions which I directed to you, and I assume that the questions which other members of the committee have directed to you, are not calculated by any stretch of the imagination to ask you where you got this matter. And I had no thought of that in the question. My question simply was that you have the matter. And would you be willing to tell the committee what that matter is? I don't want to know who gave it to you. I don't want to know how you got it. But I would like to know what it is.
That was the committee chairman, Senator Tidings. There will be more next week from Senator McCarthy. And next week, too, should see the first accused by the senator facing the committee. Here in New York, Miss Dorothy Kenyon, one-time city magistrate, recently a member of the American UN delegation, was outraged at McCarthy's accusation.
Senator McCarthy is a liar. He is taking cowardly refuge in his congressional immunity to smear innocent people. Let him ask the Soviet delegate to the Commission on the Status of Women of the United Nations whether she thinks I'm pro-communist or not. She and I have battled for years on that commission, and I have told her that the equality which she claims exists in Russia is nothing better than the equality of slavery. Do you call that being pro-communist, Senator? As for the organizations which he says I belong to, I've never heard of most of them. Some of them I vaguely remember as being groups before whom I've made a speech at one time or another. I've made many speeches before all kinds of groups, including Republicans, for many years. It's an outrage to decent Americans that somebody who knows so little about the meaning of true Americanism should be able to smear characters and thus misuse his democratic privilege of free speech.
So began another act of that never-ending show, Investigation by Congress.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history compiled by NBC's News and Special Events Department, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now from the NBC Newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
The Western world this week could show an improving score in the war of nerves with the East. Many were the signs, from Secretary Acheson's call for total diplomacy to the war games in the Caribbean. In Paris, the French Assembly beat down violent communist opposition to pass an anti-sabotage bill. Britain and France renewed their Entente Cordiale. And at the American Naval Base of Norfolk, Virginia, a grateful spokesman for the French nation watched the loading of the first American warplanes for Europe on a French aircraft carrier.
We are here today to witness the loading on a French warship of the first consignment of arms to be sent from this country to France by virtue of the military aid program. I should like first to tell you that the French government and people fully appreciate these new and generous evidence of collaboration and comprehension on the part of the United States.
Representing the USA was the Assistant Secretary of State, J.K. McFaul.
It is entirely fitting that the world take note of the initial loading of defense equipment under the Mutual Defense Assistance Program. It is momentous because it is another important development in the welding of a group of free nations into a single active force for peace.
In Washington, for a meeting of the National Women's Press Club, General Omar Bradley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, gave an answer to the question, where do we stand now in national defense?
Over a long period of peacetime, the United States should not expect to match the Soviet Union plane for plane, ship for ship, division for division, without lowering its standard of living. It is truly understood that forces in being, including ground, air, and navy, are not sufficient now to fight a major war. Nor would they be sufficient for such a calamity by the end of the fiscal year 1951. But I feel that we're going to achieve the necessary forces to prevent a disastrous attack from crippling this nation. I also believe that our forces in being and our mobilization base will be sufficient, together with the forces and potential of friendly nations, to win a war if it comes.
Generally, it was a picture of strengthened defenses this week. But for each new problem conquered, for every tension eased, another sprang up. Again in the news, that troubled city Berlin, where communists and anti-communists rioted again this week. A prelude, perhaps, to a communist vow to seize the western sector of the city. West Berlin's mayor, Ernst Reuter, told NBC of his plans in such an event.
We declare that under no circumstances we will give the enemies of democratic freedom the possibility to destroy the peaceful life in our city and to undermine our democratic order. We shall give the enemies of freedom no more freedom than is given in the east of Berlin. We shall not, therefore, make the Olympic Stadium available for these communist organizations.
A crippled United Nations had little active part in this week's diplomatic doings. Perhaps an outsider had the answer to the UN's troubles.
The Parliament of the world is still bogged down by the question of which government shall represent China. But there were some salty suggestions for a happier UN that came from that temporarily retired humorist Fred Allen, speaking to the Herald Tribune Youth Forum in New York. If comedy ruled at Lake Success, said Mr. Allen, things might be different.
With humorists running the UN, we would really see some sessions. In place of the usual opening with a Balkan delegate complaining that Greek soldiers had kidnapped two Bulgarian shepherds and their flocks of sheep with intent to commit shish kebab, obviously. Shish kebab, incidentally, hasn't come up yet at the UN as far as I've been able to determine. But instead of having the delegate open with a complaint of this sort, the session with the humorist in charge would get underway with possibly the Albanian delegate rising and telling a joke. Well, this would be a novelty. Now, he might tell a joke about the peasant who went into an eating place in Albania and ordered a chicken pie. When the chicken pie came, the peasant said, "To me, frankly, this looks to be a little tall for a chicken pie." And the waiter says, "It is tall. The chef cooked the chicken standing up." Well, when the Albanian delegate finished telling the joke in Albanian, all of the Albanians at the UN would chuckle, naturally, out of loyalty. Then the official interpreter would get busy translating the joke into different languages. Well, by the time this joke was translated into all of the different languages and explained to all of the delegates present, it would be time to adjourn for the day, and everybody would leave in a good humor. Yes, if the humorist took over the UN, ranting and recrimination would be known no more, and the halls would ring with friendly laughter.
Perhaps so, or perhaps the UN delegates could take a lesson in basic democratic procedure from that famous institution, the New England Town Meeting. This week, Voices and Events and station WBZ went to a town meeting, to the town of Truro on Cape Cod, where little has changed in the procedure in 100 or so years. As they did from the very beginning, the townspeople opened their meeting with a prayer.
Almighty God, pour out upon us, we beseech thee in this meeting, thy Holy Spirit. Lead us in all our deliberations. Keep us from doing those things which are not for the best good of our people. And we ask it in thine own holy name. Amen.
And now to business. First matter for Truro's town meeting is the question of the city dump. The moderator reads a proposal. Then the citizen stands up and gives his view.
I think that if this time, if we designate that a certain amount of this is to be paid a caretaker, and he's to be spend so many days every week, he can keep that dump in first-class shape. If it's bulldozed out and cleaned up, and Mr. Lewis or anyone else that they employ as a caretaker goes up there so many days a week, he can keep that dump good and clean, because it was proven to us in 1948.
I have a question.
Okay. These other things are only suggestions anyway. We're trying to determine how much money you're going to spend on town dumps. $1,500. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No opposition, so the townspeople vote to employ a caretaker for the dump. But when it came to employing a few extra policemen for the summer, the folks in Truro displayed a bit of Yankee thriftiness. Listen.
The territory that we've got to cover in the town of Truro requires quite a police force. I don't think two extra ones will cover it right. If you put on four extra ones, it may not cover it right. It's got to be paid by taxes.
Anything else on this motion? Article number 22. The town votes to raise and appropriate an additional sum of $2,000 to supplement the regular town police department appropriation for the purpose of adding additional policemen during the summer months. You ready for the question?
Right.
All in favor say aye.
Yes.
Opposed?
No.
And so a glimpse of how American democracy still worked in its time-tested way in the towns where it was born. This week, Voices and Events eavesdropped on some reports of some Russian town meetings. You know, it's election time this week in the USSR. They go to the polls in all the Russias this Sunday. And the not-too-burning question is, will Stalin get another term in the Supreme Soviet? We have it on good authority, that is to say, Pravda and Moscow, that the election for Stalin is in the bag. However, experts have been wrong before, so Voices and Events monitored the Russian broadcasts of the week to sample Soviet sentiment.
A report from the Krasnodar territory in the Russian Federation describes an election meeting at the Ivanov Collective Farm held to nominate a candidate for the Supreme Soviet. The first to take the floor was a tractor driver, Akulov. "I propose," he said, "that we nominate as our candidate for the Tikhoretsk constituency that untiring fighter for the working people's happiness, the great leader of the people, our wise leader and teacher, Joseph Stalin." This proposal was greeted with a stormy ovation. When quiet was restored, the speaker continued.
So, a strong grassroots movement for this incumbent, says the Moscow radio, in the coming elections for the Supreme Soviet, the parliament without dissent. The election will be a simple matter, just one ticket, you know. And already, we hear from the country districts.
A meeting was held by members of the Galabas, the Hipsley Collective Farm, in a high mountain village in Gan region. And one of the farmers who took the floor, Gafur Rachmanov, said this: "I propose nominating Comrade Stalin for the Supreme Soviet of the USSR as deputy for the mountaineers of Karategina, Darvaza, and Gorny Badakhshan."
The meeting unanimously decided to nominate Joseph Stalin for the Supreme Soviet of the USSR.
Sunday night tells the story, but there will be few indeed in Moscow or anywhere else who'll sit up all night waiting for the results. If the world looked a little heartless and hopeless this week, the American scene could note the report of one who left our firmament for a time, Clarence Storm, by trade a Navy parachutist. For his earthbound fellow citizens, parachutist Storm made a jump, carrying in his arms a miniature tape recording machine, giving a first-hand report as he bailed out. Listen now to the report of a man alone in space. You'll hear first the drone of the plane, the call of the jump master, "Stand by, jump," and then the voice of the parachutist as he plunges toward the earth.
"Stand by, jump!
That's Clarence Storm counting to 15 before he pulls the ripcord of his chute. The voice of a man hurtling through space in the terrifying moments before the canopy of silk cracks open above him. And then...
"Well, that was a nice opening. That didn't hurt me too much. I see a few little white spots up here. I probably think you might call them stars. But they aren't too bad. If you realize that I was traveling at the speed of 121 miles an hour and within about 3 seconds slowed down to 11 miles per hour, you will get an idea of just the shock the human body can take and sustain. I think it's about time to light up a cigarette. It's really beautiful up here this morning. There's a few clouds, but otherwise than that, it's really nice. I can see four little towns here in the valley: Westmoreland, Imperial, Brawley, and El Centro. The green fields really look nice. I presume they're cabbage and lettuce and alfalfa and a few other things like that. Well, it looks like I'm getting pretty close to the ground now. I have a few oscillations. I notice the ground crew heading this direction to pick me up. I'll see just what kind of a shock I'm going to sustain on landing here. Well, here I go. One, two... That was it.
For Clarence Storm, the world seemed a gentle place as he floated back to it. For others, it was a world of cold wars and espionage, in a week when mercy killings vied with diplomacy to claim the headlines, a week when the representatives of free men lost their tempers in committee, when the representatives of men in slavery set out to get themselves reelected, so to speak. That was the news. That was it.
This has been Voices and Events, the living record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. Each week at this time, Voices and Events takes you to the scene of the top news developments inside Congress, the United Nations, or a New England town meeting. Wherever news is made, here or abroad, you hear the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Your editor has been James Fleming. Portions of the program are heard around the world through the facilities of the Department of State and the Voice of America. This is Robert Warren speaking, and inviting you to listen next week at this same time for Voices and Events.
Programs, get your programs here. A top film star will introduce a motion picture hopeful tonight on Hollywood Star Theater. Hear Hollywood Star Theater and then listen as Ralph Edwards dishes out more fantastic consequences on Truth or Consequences. Yes, sir, if you can't tell the truth, you must pay the consequences. So hear Truth or Consequences on NBC tonight. And hear the stars of tomorrow on Hollywood Star Theater tonight on NBC.